Hi, and welcome to The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell. The war in Sudan is now 1 year old. It is a grim milestone, and today we are speaking with the new U.S. Special Envoy on Sudan, Tom Perriello. Crisis Group had long called for the U.S. to appoint a special envoy to supercharge peace efforts, and we are very grateful for him for taking the time to come on to talk about his plan to end the war. Perriello has a background as both a politician and a diplomat, having served as a U.S. congressman before serving previously as a special envoy for the Great Lakes region in Africa. Tom, thanks so much for coming on our show.
Thank you, Alan, and thanks to your team for the great work you guys do.
Now, you were appointed in February. With new envoys often come fresh eyes in situations like this. You've traveled around the region, talking to regional officials, Sudanese. I wanted to start off by asking you about any main impressions, takeaways, any surprises you might have from those discussions, from those travels, about the state of the war in Sudan and the state of diplomacy.
Sure. I think one thing that's been really clear from the conversations is just how unified the Sudanese people are in what they want, which is not necessarily what gets the chatter online. But in meetings with hundreds of civilians, it's clear that people want the war to end and the military and militias pulled back into barracks and beyond. They want a unified professional military. They want to recover the revolution and constitutional transition that began 5 years ago this week and have that project of inclusive democracy in Sudan. People want humanitarian access to get through, and they don't want to see violent extremists and old guard coming back into power. And so for the very real divisions that exist, I think what is very clear is that Sudanese people are united in that desire for not just peace or ceasefire, but a return to the project of that future Sudan that was coming together just a few years ago. I think the second is the degree to which desperation can create opportunity. The situation right now is barreling towards really catastrophic levels of famine, potentially a more factionalized conflict, a more regional conflict. And that, I think, has engaged some of the key actors, both internally and in the region, in a way that the horrific issue of atrocities and violence had not necessarily seized that set of actors. And so there is, I think, a sense of diplomatic urgency. And when you compare a deal to that bad of an outcome, then the deal starts to look much more attractive to a broader range of actors. So it's hard to be optimistic with Sudan right now, but I do think that there's an awareness that right now, left to the current momentum, we are headed in a truly disastrous direction. And I think that is getting the elevation we've seen, both in the U.S. government and elsewhere, of greater interest, greater priority, greater pressure to get to a peace deal. And hopefully that urgency will be enough. But time is not currently on our side, or more importantly, the side of the Sudanese.
So I wanted to dive straight into that. What is your plan to end the war? What is the U.S. plan under your special envoyship to reach a ceasefire and then try to move Sudan forward from that?
Well, we are very eager to get the talks started in Jeddah restarted, and the Saudis have committed to that and to inclusive talks with the key actors. We do not yet have a date. Maybe by the time this podcast is posted, we will. And we would certainly like to come out of the meetings in Paris with momentum towards talks. But I think it's also important to note that we're not waiting for formal talks to begin to be negotiating and pushing for this solution. You can see that in the shuttle diplomacy, the almost manic level of shuttle diplomacy that we've been doing, but also many others, including key actors in the region, trying to convince everyone that it is in the interests of the region and the world for us to get to a deal with a unified Sudan and a unified professional army and a return to that democratic project. So I think in that case, we know the neighbors are key actors, the players in the Gulf are key actors. We have the French government hosting this donor conference, which is another piece of this that we can talk about, the humanitarian crisis and the truly pitiful amount of international aid that has moved into a crisis that's involving tens of millions of people facing horrific conditions. So right now, I think formal talks, but in the build up to that, really supercharging the shuttle diplomacy and trying to get key actors to understand the importance of supporting this deal. And I think that we know there continues to be fighting internally. And right now, the two sides seem to be negotiating with guns and not at the table. And that's not a good scenario for anyone. But we do think that the U.S. can play a very substantial role on this. But obviously, this is something that is going to require a broader set of key players to come together to compel a deal.
There's a lot for us to get into from there. But you mentioned shuttle diplomacy with all the various actors. Have you engaged the belligerents themselves?
Yeah, we are, you know, in contact with both sides about issues from humanitarian access to the negotiations. I think that, you know, it is a really fragile time. We're seeing both divisions internally on both sides. We are seeing bombing of civilian areas. We're seeing the sieging of Al-Fashir. We're seeing continued reports of atrocities and abuse of humanitarian workers and others. It is important for both sides to understand that obviously we've issued sanctions from the U.S. government. The possibility of those sanctions being increased, but also efforts to really get people to the peace deal that returns power to the people of Sudan and to the path that they were on.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that the formal track in Jeddah, which has been stagnant, I think, since November, basically. Should people expect this to be the same Jeddah process that was there before, or is Jeddah basically a place and we'd be looking at something quite a bit different, perhaps more high level, perhaps more focused on a ceasefire, perhaps, you know, a broader set of actors?
We think it's important for us to be ending this war now, all of us who are in a position to help make that happen. Therefore, the priority is to put together the pieces that of a peace deal that would end the war and return power to that constitutional transition. That is not an easy thing to do with the number of factors that are on the table, but it's also true that we don't need to renegotiate questions that the Sudanese people have already decided. And back, you know, 5 years ago with the constitutional transition, there was already a great deal of work and inclusion of Sudanese voices and regional actors to create a path. And no country gets that right the first time. There are always going to be setbacks on that kind of a constitutional transition to democracy, as there was in our country here, several. And so I think we do want to get back to that and look at an end deal, which isn't to say that we will not also look for opportunities for, you know, ceasefires, whether localized or otherwise. But the goal right now is to end this war and to get Sudan back on that path that the Sudanese people so courageously put together just 5 years ago. So in that sense, I do think the urgency of the crisis is increasing the need for us to focus on those kind of endgame conversations. And I think, frankly, that's part of where you're seeing more engagement from some of the key actors on some of those questions and some of the issues internally.
Now, a lot of the questions revolving around Jeddah have been about if any other major powers would be invited besides the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, who convened the talks, and then IGAD was there for the last round. But specifically, does it look like Egypt and the Emiratis would have a role, as they've been having their own efforts, in a sense, to try to bring the two belligerents closer to a deal as well?
So we do think it's important for not just AU and IGAD, but also the Egyptians and the Emiratis to be part of the conversation. The Saudis have agreed to that. And I think in many ways, I see you were talking earlier about, is Jeddah just a place? In some ways, Jeddah is almost a jar that is catching all of these pieces, or I said at one point, a greatest hits album, right? Because we've learned things from these various initiatives that I think have been constructive, whether that's the Manama process or Egypt's engagement. Each of those can be a piece of what is getting us to a deal in Jeddah. We do think that process has got a key role, and we've heard even from some who've been critical of Jeddah that it is there's a need to consolidate these processes and get to that endgame conversation. I think that's what Jeddah can represent, and I think in doing so, it is very important to have key actors at the table who, you know, have both a historic and a future commitment and interest in Sudan, and also, frankly, have leverage with some of the key actors that we will need to end this war. So inclusive talks, yes, in Jeddah. I think a consolidation of these earlier processes is of great interest. And then running parallel to that is, again, this issue of engaging the Sudanese people. And for us, that is our North Star. And that's why I, you know, when you first asked, what has been useful in this case for me is this idea that the Sudanese people are very clear about what they want. They're very unified in what they want. Obviously, when it gets to the questions of political parties and positions, just like in the United States, you don't have consensus. You don't expect consensus on questions of politics. But on the questions that are actually relevant to the negotiations, there's tremendous unity. And I think we are trying to ensure that that is the baseline, non-negotiable of these talks. And again, this is something where the Sudanese people are not just clear now. They have already done this, and they did this before in setting up the constitutional transition that was years, decades in the making, and we need to get back to that future that yet was. And I think that's what people want. And again, just like we can learn from some of these other efforts at peace talks and bring that into Jeddah, we can learn from some of the strengths and weaknesses of that constitutional transition as we make a long-term commitment to the Sudanese people on this project that will take years to build strong democratic institutions, to ensure inclusivity, questions of federalism. These are very, very important questions, but those are not questions that need to be part of negotiations to end the war. This is about getting back to the kind of civilian government and eventually elections within which those long-term questions can be debated and decided through a political process by the Sudanese people. So I think in that sense, we need to not overcomplicate what issues really are crucial for ending the war and returning that process versus questions that are fascinating and important, but are part of, again, a different phase of building that future democratic Sudan.
And you've referenced several times the sort of shuttle diplomacy around the region with major powers, especially Arab powers in the region. You know, there are plenty of reasons to be pessimistic about the trajectory of the war, especially internally, and we'll get to that in a bit. But what have you found in your conversations in terms of the interests of some of the regional powers, especially Egypt and the UAE, as well as Saudi Arabia? They haven't been on the same page for most of this war. Do you see a way to bring them all together, you know, with at least an interest to end the war? And where is that coming from, and why now?
I think that there is a lot of alignment, or there at least should be. Whether or not we've gotten there is an active question. But there's one thing that I think everyone agrees on, which is that everybody is going to lose and pay a huge price if we let this war continue. And I do think that message is getting through to a lot of quarters. The a failed state, a situation in which more of the ethnic militias that have stayed out of the war get pulled in, and that has implications for pulling in neighboring countries. This could be a 20 or 25 year crisis of not just a humanitarian crisis, but a regional strategic crisis. And that is a very real possibility on the table right now. And I think all of the key actors inside and outside do not benefit from that. Maybe some of the hardcore Islamist elements want to see that, but in terms of the serious actors inside and outside, there's total alignment, I think, that that is a fail. I think while some have flirted with the idea of a split state, I think all of the serious analysts agree. Not only is that not a good outcome, but it's not a stable outcome. It would almost certainly then revert to exactly the same regional and ethnic war, because how do you draw that line and who's in charge of which side? So I think that that leaves people with a necessity to come up with the alternative. And the question of alignment there, I think, is if everybody moves out of a maximalist position. Now, for us, it's easy because we're being guided by what we hear from the Sudanese people and what they want, and this return to, again, the constitutional transition as they've had it. But there is also thing, you know, respect for the military and a desire for a unified professional military as an institution that is strong, professional, and accountable going forward. So there are a lot of those elements there for us that we, you know, hear in consultation with the Sudanese. But for those who may be more driven by other internal interests, I think this is a situation where if you move off a maximalist position, there is a lot of benefit from restabilizing the country. And I do think that there were times in this war where one might credibly think that one side or the other could either win outright or get to a more dominant position. But I think there is a growing sense of stalemate and attrition. Obviously, there are ongoing battles with that. You know, you've seen SAF make significant gains in Omdurman and the symbolic victories of getting back TV and radio, but that's still not, you know, all of Khartoum, where many, many people are suffering in, you know, particularly in the RSF territories. So I think we're looking at a situation in which if you move off of that mythical notion that one side could win outright, and you're flirting with this total disaster of failed state, then I think it's not hard for people to look rationally and say, hey, everyone is going to benefit from coming back off that cliff and reestablishing, you know, this constitutional transition and building from there. Now, we live in the real world. We know that there's, you know, a lot of factors at play for various actors inside and outside. But the fact is that this is now a situation where there should be mutual self-interest in getting to a deal that hands Sudan back to the Sudanese people. And then we commit to a much longer term partnership of trying to build out stronger institutions and other elements of that.
So we've talked a lot about the external actors, and at Crisis Group, we've been stressing since the beginning of this war that, sort of as you're referencing here, that it looked like something of a prerequisite to probably making progress on ending this war, that you would need more alignment among the outside Arab powers, especially that have the most leverage over these two sides. But of course, there is the position of the two belligerents themselves. Based off of some of these informal discussions that you've been having, that some of these other powers have been having directly with the belligerents, how close do you think they are to a deal? And how ready do you think the two sides are actually to negotiate at this point?
It's somewhat natural in a full-on kinetic war that the two individuals least likely to want to sit down with each other are the people leading the two fighting forces. And I think that that's certainly something we think has value. Various folks have had attempts at getting the two of them together, and they certainly have worked together in the past. They conducted the coup together. There's been a long tradition of SAF-RSF relations, but we are a year into a very violent and bloody war. And so we understand that that may not be the most immediate or fertile line. That being said, I do think that there are reasons that each of them and their leadership teams could see a reason to end this war. And we are going to continue to both raise the costs to them of negative activities and atrocities, but also be doing what we can to bring them to the table into a peace deal. And I think, you know, particularly if you think about what General Burhan and others have said about wanting to hand power back to a civilian government and about wanting SAF protected as an institution, you know, I think that many of the Sudanese people see a future in which those things are the case. There's reason to be hopeful that we can get to that agreement. I think that agreement is more likely if we can get key external actors aligned behind that deal and explaining why this framework that I think has been set first and foremost by the Sudanese people is the right path forward.
Now, I want to zero in there a bit more on the army side, the Burhan side, which has really had its first military gains over the past few months. You know, many are skeptical that Burhan is really ready to talk right now to end the war, especially given that recent military momentum. Do you have any reason to believe that he can be pressured to actually sign a deal at this point, that he would even have the internal consensus and coherence within the officer corps to sign any deal right now, given the current state of the conflict?
I think General Burhan cares deeply about his country. I think he cares deeply about the institution of the army, with a history that's older than the country itself. I want to believe that if there's a deal on the table that protects Sudan and the Sudanese people and honors the institution of SAF, that he very much wants to see and be a bridge back to that constitutional transition that the Sudanese people deserve and worked so hard to get. I think that there are certainly aspects of, you know, the conditions of what that deal would look like that matter to him a great deal. But I do think that he starts from a position of a great deal of love for the country, not wanting to see it divided. And there's agreement that we should be looking to an integrated professional military. So yes, I think that there is that. I think that it's very unfortunate that we've seen SAF shut down humanitarian border access, and also unfortunate that we've seen RSF looting humanitarian efforts and harassing and harming humanitarian workers. And I think if we can pull back to a situation that focuses on the future, we can get there. In fact, I think it's probably easier, particularly for someone like General Burhan, to be seeing the value of a deal more than maybe the value of negotiations. And so I think there's an issue where we don't want to get so focused on the process, which can be its own set of negotiations, than on the outcome. And I think there's a lot about the outcome that the Sudanese people want that can be very consistent with what General Burhan has talked about being his motivations and his hopes for the future.
Hmm. It sounds like to me from some of what you said that, you know, there's been a lot of focus, including from us, on kind of the various different tracks and processes and getting them all together. But you seem a bit less worried that there might be parallel efforts, different efforts from different parties, as long as they're all pushing in the same direction, ultimately.
I think that last part is the key. I think if it's tributaries feeding into a river that can carry us to a peace deal, then it's great. We have not had enough collective force and pressure in that river to move us to a peace deal. But because we haven't had that, it's all the more reason that if it's a tributary that's actually taking water off of that river or out of that river, which I think is probably not a tributary, but I'm going to mix up my metaphors here, then that's something we really cannot afford. But anything that is, I think, helping to build alignment around ending this war and ending this war on terms that have been set by the Sudanese people is constructive, it's additive. And at the same time, I think that has served a purpose over the last few months. And what we are hearing, including from many of those who have tried those tributary efforts, is now is the time to bring these efforts together. JETA, an inclusive JETA process, is the right flow, right river. And with that, we hope we've now built enough momentum that that can get us to a peace deal. So I think that we are largely seeing that in most of the governments, certainly the ones that I'm meeting with, more and more senior level engagement, more and more understanding about the urgency of getting to a deal. And I think in most cases, those efforts to bring together key actors have been motivated by a shared desire to end this war and find that alignment. So we'll have another opportunity in Paris with some of those conversations. Again, we hope we'll have a date for JETA very soon. And even once we have that date, of course, so much of the work happens before people get together. And I think that's where it is just a sense of wanting to realize that this was a war of choice. This was not a war of necessity, and that in many ways, returning to the status quo ante, not of a year ago, but of a few years ago, and getting back to that constitutional transition is a very real option on the table if cooler heads can prevail, and that everybody can see some benefits to the future in that path. So, you know, I think most of these efforts have been constructive. You know, we can draw kind of the energy from those and now focus those into a process, hopefully, to end the war. And I want to be clear in saying that. I'm not saying this is a slam dunk. We are playing against the odds in many ways, both in terms of time and in terms of some key pain points or choke points in those talks. But I do think that there's reason for hope, certainly relative to where things were a few months ago, based on, in part, just how bad things have gotten, based on an elevation of, I think, interest in diplomatic engagement from some key actors, and hopefully bringing those key players together in JETA soon to see if we can end this war and give the Sudanese people their future back.
And of course, your appointment as a special envoy is one of the key elevating steps that has happened over the past few months. I'm wondering, just quickly before we move on, what you see as the likely major sticking points to a deal, the really hard obstacles and hurdles to get over and bridge between these two sides to actually get something that looks like a ceasefire deal.
In many ways, the biggest barrier right now is trust. And I think that we've had principles coming out of earlier JETA talks that were not implemented. We have two sides that are fighting each other. And in some ways, I think the barrier has been the extent to which people want to see kind of that first step. And there are some times where that's the right way to try to build confidence back, confidence building measures. And there are other times where the only potential for alignment is to get the actors to look three or four moves down the chessboard. Because if you're only looking one move at a time, then it's easy to see everything in a zero-sum game, particularly where there's no trust. And instead, I think trying to get us all to look at where this could go and how good of an outcome that could be for the country of Sudan and for the region, versus the path that we're on. And so I think that's a key. The other, I think, is really trying to ensure that the Sudanese people remain central actors in determining their future. And that's always difficult when you do not have an existing elected government of what is the right way to ensure that the Sudanese people are being engaged. And this is one of the reasons I think it's so important to not renegotiate more things than we have to that have already been decided by the Sudanese people in terms of those baselines of the earlier constitutional transition. And I think trying to really center huge amount of unity. The second you get to questions like, political parties and names, that's a natural place for disagreement, and that should play out through an election process. But the reality is, the Sudanese people are, again, tremendously united on these core four or five planks of ending the war, opening up the borders to access, not seeing extremists come in and a return to the constitutional transition and a unified professional army. So I think we really need to make sure as we go forward that that unity is being understood and amplified at the same time that we have honest conversations about where those divisions are and when and how those divisions should play out. So again, I think that there are a lot of factors moving in, but it is going to be difficult in terms of trust. And this may be a place where some of the regional actors, including those who've been arguably on different sides of this fight, it may be easier for cooler heads to prevail there than among the actors that are actively fighting each other in multiple locations across the country, which again is just difficult to get to.
Yeah, so I think one of the key dilemmas as part of this sort of outside-in strategy that you're describing of getting regional alignment and then pushing it on the parties has been that Burhan has had to accept quite a lot of help from what many are calling Islamists, but essentially officials from Bashir's regime, from his old political party, as well as essentially Islamist organized militias fighting on his side. Now, the ceasefire efforts that have taken place, including with U.S. support in the Arab world, these have mostly thus far centered on sidelining and re-isolating those Islamist elements. And it's also a core demand of many Sudanese, of course. But I'm just wondering, given that they are playing such a major role in the war, given how powerful they seem to be within Burhan's side of the equation, I'm wondering, can Burhan actually do that? Is that reasonable? Might we have to consider other ways of thinking about how to incentivize those groups to also want to end this war?
So first of all, let's start with where the Sudanese people are. I think it's clear that they are not looking for a return of a old regime that they risked their lives to push out of power 5 years ago. And there is no appetite in any of the Sudanese with whom I speak anywhere across the country or outside that is looking for Iran or Islamist extremists to play a larger role in this war. Second, I think that probably the strength of the hardliners and some of those influences is overstated by a lot of the actors on the outside, but I think it's more a question of the fear of how quickly that strength could grow over the coming months if this war is not brought to an end. And I say that because you've seen, hardliners come out and talk about the military holding on to power, and then you see Kibaki come out and basically shoot that down and say, no, we understand that we're giving power back to civilians. I think in terms of the popular mobilization, if you're homes are under attack and somebody comes in and offers you weapons and training to protect your family, you're very likely to participate in that, but that doesn't mean you accept the ideology. So I think that's not a ideological recruitment shift. But if you go on for 6 months or 12 months in the trenches in that situation, I think that can actually then metastasize into something that is more of a Islamist extremist base. Our sense is that the military leadership does have the, command and control authority and the ability to negotiate in the ways that they need to. But I think it is also something where the regional actors and others together should be concerned that, again, if we do not find a resolution to this war, those kinds of elements are likely to grow. And nobody inside Sudan or in the region benefits from a failed state, with the exception, as I said before, of potentially these extremist elements who would, in some cases, like to see one of the largest countries in the region, in the Sahel, becoming a failed state and a breeding ground for terrorism. So I think we are right to be concerned about it, but I think it's also, you know, maybe important not to overstate how entrenched those powers are, but that's also something we'll see in the context of negotiations and other dynamics. But I think this also goes to the point I was making earlier, that I think for some of the individuals, and I think SAF leadership is in this, there should be seen as a lot of benefits to the deal that the Sudanese people want, more than necessarily the negotiating process within which it is easier for, say, hardliners or others to be spoilers than to a deal itself. So I think people who care about Sudan, we definitely need to be focused on that process of formal talks and getting them started, but also be looking at the outcome and reminding the parties that there's a lot that can be seen as a win in the context of what the Sudanese people want.
Now, if you do manage against all odds to get a ceasefire and get one sometime relatively soon, you've referenced at several points needing to get back to the Sudanese transition that was there after the revolution, before the military takeover, before the war. A transition to democracy. So just to press you on what a political process might look like after a ceasefire in your mind, even if that's a bit hazy at this point. And then a deeper question, which is it really reasonable to expect the two warring sides to hand over any power when they weren't willing to do so before the war and have now spilled so much blood in order to hang on to power?
So I get very excited thinking about the civilian process that could be in the medium term. And I think this is one of the reasons why we want to protect as many of the core issues as possible for that medium term that is then determined by the Sudanese people under the restored constitutional transition and then eventually under elections. The Sudanese people have been incredibly innovative in doing wide-scale engagement, as we saw during the resistance eras and the revolution. I want to believe that we can get to a point where the combination of this, you know, very innovative, cutting-edge Sudanese youth, digital organizing with the traditional leaders that exist at the village level and connecting those two up, as we've seen, it does have the capacity, once there's no longer fighting and people can return, to be engaging thousands of Sudanese. And I think that's what people want, is that kind of engagement in the medium term to long term, so that you can build the both traditional and new structures of democratic governance. And, you know, that's not possible when people are being bombed and shelled and starved. It's not possible when the internet is down in much of the country, though we have seen some of that come back online. So again, I think what we want to do is get the war ended, get the civilians back in and in power and safe for those that are inside, and then have both that interim period of constitutional transition and then obviously elections. And there are big questions of how long is one and the other. And those things, I think it's important to just know, like, this isn't the first time these things have happened. We have best practices. We have lessons both from the Sudanese case and more broadly. But I see this as a, you know, I think we need to see this as an exciting opportunity and not as a technocratic barrier to the peace deal, because the Sudanese people have already shown their ability to speak out and engage. I think what people are also saying, though, right now, and this goes to, I think, the degree of the crisis, is there are people that are starving, literally starving right now. And I think the international community has done a pitiful job of meeting the minimum response of humanitarian needs, even outside of Sudan, even a place like Chad that's been a quite permissive environment for refugee camps traditionally. We're not even getting a meal a day to people that are up in eastern Chad. And this is an outrage. And I'm proud the U.S. has done over $1 billion, and we're doing more now, but it shouldn't be us doing more than the rest of the world combined. And I know there are many crises out there, but this is a situation where only 5% of the need has been met. We appreciate the French organizing this donor conference. We hope we'll be seeing more pledges, including from European counterparts, Gulf counterparts, et cetera. But we are seeing a level of fragility that is extremely raw and real. And of course, we're headed into the rainy season and other assets and the lean season. So this is something where I think in the near term, the world has got to show that it cares and that it sees this conflict and it sees the Sudanese people.
Mm. Thanks, Tom. You've been very generous with your time. I was about to ask you about how to prevent famine, but I'll go ahead and move on to my last question, which is a bit of a more personal one. You know, you have a background as a politician. You were a congressman. You've also been an activist, a political activist in various roles. This is unlike most diplomats who work on this region, who have worked on this war. I'm just wondering how those other hats might shape how you approach this job compared to others.
So, yeah, I mean, in college, I made this decision to try to test a different theory of change every 2 years in my life. And I think the benefit of that is that in looking at a situation like this, I try to see all the different pieces and angles and roles and the differences between, for example, the role of activists and organizers versus politicians. And they do speak different love languages. And I think we need to figure out how to, again, make sure that the political process, which is often very competitive and very adversarial, is given space to breathe and to play out, but that is not always the same thing as the organizing and civilian space that we see doing everything from the emergency response rooms and setting up local kitchens to the organizing to end the war, but also have been embedded with armed groups and done analysis, not unlike ICG type analysis, on some of the power dynamics and command and control dynamics in fighting forces. And I think that's helpful in understanding some of the questions you've asked about earlier and where are their divisions, where's their unity, where's their alignment and incentives. But I will also say that, you know, I think that I'll say two things. One is it doesn't really have to do with me at all. The dynamics here are much bigger than me and my perspective. I think what you have is a ripeness that wasn't there before necessarily, at least that's what we're hoping to convince people, that this is a time where it is in everyone's interest to move towards that end game. I will say the last thing that may have come across here that may come from that background, which is that you'll sense hope from me. That is not something that probably most people associate with looking at the Sudan portfolio right now. But this does come from a history of really just being witness to the courage, particularly of women, including African women, being able to look at a conflict that other people think ending is hopeless and find a way through. And that was certainly my experience in Sierra Leone, working with market women in civil society in a war that had gone on for more than a decade. And so I do think that what I found in the past is when you actually center the people and you particularly listen to women and youth who have so much more invested in the future, you can see paths. And usually the limiting factor is political will. It's not the lack of a path forward. And I think while each conflict is different and there are many ways in which this peace deal will be different and that path will be different, what is the same is when you actually spend time talking to the Sudanese people, the path is pretty clear. And the question is the political will there? And I think right now, the job of all of us in diplomacy is to make sure the political will is there within our own governments, with the key actors who've been both fueling this conflict and or are in a position to help end this conflict. And I think that if we can build that political will, we can have that path to peace. So I'm not saying it's even a 50-50 shot right now, but it is a meaningful chance to that. And I think that's probably one of the things I've taken away from both some of the political experiences, the peace negotiating positions, and other things. And hopefully I can bring a little bit of that into this process here.
Once again, many thanks, Tom, for having this conversation with us, being very generous with your time and your insights.
Thank you very much. And I will just say we have had so little attention on Sudan from the press and elsewhere. We do appreciate that your organization has taken it seriously and kept drawing attention to it. We need far more institutions and organizations to be shining a light on the situation in Sudan.
Thanks so much for listening. Once again, The Horn is a podcast of the International Crisis Group and is produced by Mae Francis and Ida Holly-Nambi.